Hi, Priyanka. Thanks so much for making me welcome on the show. I'm David Lamott. I'm a singer-songwriter. I'm a writer of books as well, and a speaker and a holder of space for conversations that I hope matter, and an everyday activist. I live in the mountains of Western North Carolina. It's really a treat to be with you and to have a little time to talk about some things that matter.
Thanks a lot, David. And I think going straight into your work, I was really intrigued by the book White Flower. I haven't really read it yet, but then I've read the gist of it, and I'm curious what inspired you to write this book, or what was happening in 2007 that made you feel that this story had to be told.
So I put out a book called White Flower, Flour, in 2012. That was about an event that happened in 2007. It's a true story. I took a few liberties, but basically, I took this story and made it rhyme and illustrated it. The book looks like a children's book, but it's actually for adults, as are all of my favorite children's books. So what happened was there was a neo-Nazi and Klan rally in 2007, espousing some views that a lot of local folks really wanted to oppose. And they were thinking about how to do that. And this story is such an important story of creative nonviolence. And that's why I wanted to amplify it. So I wrote a poem about what happened, and then I illustrated it and made a book out of that. Basically, what happened was that when this rally happened in the downtown, the Klan and the neo-Nazis reserved the square downtown for 4 hours. And the counter-protesters, who were made up of local environmental activists, staged some street theater in response. Walter Wink used to write about third way responses, about creative nonviolence, because our first natural responses don't require much creativity. Of course, fight and flight come very naturally. When people are aggressive, it's natural to be aggressive in return or to run away. But our best responses often are creative responses because neither of those really seems to work out very well. So these folks organized a group called the Coup, COUP, Klutz, CLUTZ, Clowns. And the Ku Klux Clowns met the Ku Klux Klan that day. And the Klan actually was so baffled by their response that they left an hour and a half early. It worked so much better than fight or flight would have worked. So they organized some street theater. And when the Klan started chanting white power, the clowns started chanting white flower in response. And they pulled out big bags of flour and threw it at each other and had a big flower fight in the street. And people were laughing. And it was exactly the wrong kind of energy for the Klan. It was the opposite of what they were trying to create. They worked that gag for a minute and then they said, "No, I think we heard them wrong. It wasn't white flour, it was white flowers." And they handed out flowers to everybody. And then they said, "No, that wasn't it at all. It was tight showers." And they held up a camp shower and crowded beneath it. And then they said, "No, that wasn't it at all. This is a rally for wife power." And they pulled on wedding dresses and chanted, "Here's to wives and mothers." And the way the poem and the book end is kind of the heart of it. It says, "And what would be the lesson of that shiny southern day? Can we understand the message that the clown sought to convey? It seems that when you're fighting hatred, hatred's not the thing to use. So here's to those who march on in their big red floppy shoes." So I felt like it was a story that needed to be amplified because it's very instructive. And a lot of moving things have happened with the book in the years that since it came out, a little over a decade now. But the most moving thing was that after George Floyd was murdered, the Essence magazine, which is a magazine by and for African American women, put out an article called 11 Books to Help Your Children Understand Racism. And they listed my book as number four. I was more moved by that accolade than any other.
This is
Yeah, I
really
can.
interesting. And what I really picked up on is creative nonviolence. And I wonder, could you tell me a little bit about what that means to you and how it could be applied in today's world? And also in the book, there's all of this white flower and all these phrases that they used. Was that a form of creative nonviolence?
So this story is really one of my favorite examples of creative nonviolence, partly because it's modern. It happened actually not far from where I am geographically, but also not so long away in time. So many of the examples we give when we're trying to teach about nonviolence, for kids today, I think it feels like it happened in black and white. It happened in another era that's just too far away to be relatable. So these modern examples of creative nonviolence are really quite important. And nonviolence, of course, is not just about not being violent. It's about finding solutions, finding creative ways forward to transform the world around us and ourselves without resorting to violence, which we often, I think culturally, people assume that violence is the strong thing, the thing that works. But we don't really measure violence and nonviolence by the same metrics. The truth is that violence very often leads to more violence, and very often doesn't work to achieve the goals of the people who employ it. Nonviolence turns out to work much better, actually, than violence does in terms of recent revolutions in the last 30 years or so. Some really interesting academic study has been done comparing violent revolutions to nonviolent revolutions, and the nonviolent ones turn out to be more successful.
Do you feel nonviolence could be something that could be used to address the ongoing wars right now? Or is it more, do you feel these days it's more about do you see negotiations and dialogue as a form of nonviolence?
Well, I was at a conference years ago in the United States here, and people were there from around the world, and I said something about alternative conflict resolution. And I was putting alternative conflict resolution in contrast to legal issues. And a lawyer came up to me afterwards and said, "You know, the law is alternative conflict resolution already, right? Because the natural ways to resolve conflict involve violence. The law is a step away from that." I think that's absolutely right, and I was glad to be corrected in that way. And I think there are even better ways to address conflict than legal wrangling. Mediation is a powerful force, and many, many academic studies have shown that people are so much happier coming out of a mediation scenario than they are after a legal fight. Even the winners of a legal fight often rate their satisfaction with the process very, very low. So there's a lot that we can do. But to come back to your question, in terms of war and physical conflict, yes, I think negotiation and dialogue are a form of nonviolence very often, although they can involve a whole lot of pressure. There is certainly coercion in that process. But I think the most important work of nonviolence happens before and after overt conflict. It's often asked of people who argue for nonviolence, you know, what are you going to do when somebody comes up and attacks you violently, right? What do you do when one nation invades another sovereign nation? How are you going to do that nonviolently? And Gene Sharp, the great nonviolence theorist, wrote, you know, he got kind of angry when people would say that. He's like, look, you're driving a car at 100 miles toward the top of a cliff at 100 miles per hour, and you're asking me in the last 3 feet what I'm going to do now. The work of nonviolence should have started long, long before. So there are many ways to address conflict scenarios before they get to violence, and that's where we have our best chance to stem the tide, I believe. So it's a lifestyle. It's not just when a situation pops up, how do we deal with it? It has to do with addressing the justice issues that are generally long, long in the making before violence actually breaks out.
That's really interesting. And I'm curious, what got you into discussing and writing and even singing about these topics?
So I grew up in the 80s in the United States. I'm in my mid-50s now. So it was the Reagan administration. It was the last days of the Cold War. And mutually assured destruction was a term that people talked about quite a lot at the time, when the Soviet Union and the United States were in a big arms race with nuclear arms. And it felt very precarious to me, even as a teenager. I really wondered if I would make it into my 20s because it felt like, Any small provocation could set off a nuclear Armageddon at that time. And I actually don't think I was wrong about that. Happily, we skirted those provocations, but it could easily have gone the other way. So I was looking at a world full of conflict, and of course, conflict on a local level in my community and around me in more personal ways. And I was thinking, I wish there was a better way to do this. I got to college and I began to learn about mediation and alternative conflict resolution. And I did some study and some training at the Community Mediation Center in Harrisonburg, Virginia, where I was going to college at the time. And I started to learn about this and I realized that it is learnable and it is teachable. And I started to wonder why this isn't a required course in every middle school in the nation to learn about how to do conflict. What could be a more practical skill than to learn healthier ways to address conflict? And let me be clear, conflict is not always a bad thing. Conflict is very often necessary on the way to justice. But the work of peacemaking for me is about approaching conflict in ways that are constructive rather than destructive. That's the work before us. And I got more and more passionate about that as I went through college. And I also started performing out publicly in college. And so both of these passions kind of took a hold of me in those early years of my 20s. And they've only gotten deeper over the years.
And is that what also got you to singing? I think you do sing a lot about these topics, and I wondered if there's a particular song that you feel is really prevalent to the conflicts that are going on in the world today, and those lyrics will probably gel with people. Is there anything you'd like to share?
I am moved by music, and so I think it's a natural thing to want to make music that connects with people's hearts, and hopefully that happens from time to time. I do sing about issues from time to time, but I don't really think of myself as a movement singer or a political singer. I'm really just trying to sing about what it is to be human and say things that are true in my songs and that maybe call us to our deeper selves. But I'm not trying to coerce people to think like me in my music. I really want to just sing about what's true. And part of what's true for me is that we could be doing better when it comes to peace issues. I don't think peace is a static state that we are trying to achieve. I don't think it's about getting there and solving all the problems. The question isn't for me, is peace possible? The question is more peace possible? Can we be doing any better than we're doing right now? And I think we can. I don't know if this is making it across the ocean, but in the United States right now, there's some controversy about a country song that came out recently that seems to be threatening violence to progressive activists. It says, "Don't try that in a small town." And it begins with a line about a gun that the singer's grandfather gave to him. So it seems a pretty clear threat, although it's not completely explicit, to not try progressive movement work in a small town. Well, I live in a small town in the South, and I am a Southerner. And so it's important to me to that people understand that the South is not monolithic, that everybody doesn't approach things the same way in the South. For one thing, there's a Southern experience that doesn't have to do with being white. But even me, as a white Southerner, I don't want people to assume that I buy into things that seem to be conflated in a song like that. So often, Southern culture is equated with support for the Confederacy and for racism. And that's not who I am. It's not what I stand for. So I wrote a song a couple of years ago. It's on my most recent album that came out last year called Look Away. The unofficial anthem of the Confederacy is a song called Dixie. And that song says, "Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland," in the chorus. And I was an adult before I realized that that song is saying the quiet part out loud. Because looking away is precisely what we've been doing in the South for many years, looking away from the hard parts of our history and not wanting to talk about it. And I think the only way toward healing is going to be talking about the hard parts. And it's a mark of maturity to be able to talk about difficult things. So it's deeply troubling to me in the South right now in the United States that there are a lot of movements to ban books and to limit the teaching of history. And exclude things that make people feel uncomfortable. Because I think we have to be uncomfortable in order to grow and in order to heal. So that song, Look Away, I made a video for it with my friend Hannah Garrity, a brilliant artist. And we are kind of playing into the fact it's actually a Southern rock song. It sounds very Southern. And the video has a lot of classic Southern images in the visuals as well. But we're making the argument in the video that there's more than one way to be Southern, and that you can actually stand for inclusion and be an authentic Southerner. So that's a song that's been on my heart recently, and one that I've been enjoying putting out into the world.
I think one thing that you said here was, what can we be doing more for peace? And I wondered, is that sort of what inspired you to write your other book?
So this new book is called You Are Changing the World Whether You Like It or Not. And that's a little bit cheeky to say it quite that way, but I think it needs to be said that there's a lot of eye rolling. There's a little bit of dismissive attitude that comes up when you talk about changing the world. And I think part of the reason for that is that we use these three phrases interchangeably: change the world, and fix the world, and save the world. And those are actually three completely different things. If you think you can fix the world, that is worthy of an eye roll. That's naive. You can't fix the world. If you think you can save the world, I don't necessarily think it's my job to save the world, and I'm not sure it's possible. But changing the world is a different concept. It is not naive to think you can change the world. It is naive to think you could possibly be in the world and not change it. Everything we do changes the world. So the question is how much intention we're going to bring to the changes that we want to make. And I think part of the issue there is that we have cultural narratives about heroes changing things, right? Big dramatic actions seem to change the world in movies and sometimes in history classes. But actually, that's never been the way it's happened, that one person has effected a large-scale social change in the absence of a movement. What changes things is a lot of people moving in the same direction. That's what a movement is. And that's the real work ahead of us. So that's good news and bad news. The good news is you're not powerless. You can show up and do a little bit, and that actually does matter. The bad news is you're not powerless. So that means you may have some work to do.
You think it's easy though to change the world because there are challenges that you might come across in some countries. It's just the current situation of conflict. There's also this debate that you need to have a certain level of privilege to be able to make changes. What do you have to say to these kind of barriers that do? Maybe barrier is not the right word, but for some people it is a barrier. Maybe they dream of changing the world, but they just don't have the resources at their end. So then how do you address this?
Absolutely. Well, let me take both of those questions because they're both really good. First one, no, I don't think it's easy. It's not even a little bit easy. It's very hard. And I think we need to remember that small actions actually do count. They're the only thing that's ever changed the world, an accumulation of small actions. So it's important to just remember that you don't have to be a big dramatic hero to have an effect, because the room that you're in right now, the town that you're in right now, is part of the world. And if you change that, if you change a dynamic within your family, you are literally changing the world. And when you look at really big issues like toxic governmental power, that's huge, right? And it takes a lot of change there. But when we look at the positive changes that have happened in the world, it's always been movements. It's always been a lot of people showing up to do a little bit each. The one person doing the big dramatic heroic thing has no effect unless all the others show up. So I think it's important to realize that, to remember that we're not powerless. As for privilege, yes, absolutely. It matters what your social location is, and we should never discount that and assume that the playing field is flat, because it's not. It's tilted towards some people. And I happen to have been dealt a whole lot of the privilege cards in the world, right? So what that means is not that I'm a good person or a bad person. It means that there's stuff that I don't see, and I need to listen deeply to people at the margins so that I can learn from them because they can see better from there than I can see from the middle. That said, I do think that all of us have a little bit of privilege, and all of us have at least a little bit of power. I just returned from Guatemala, from rural Guatemala, where I was with some friends there who were not born into any of the privilege that I was born into. And they're making massive changes in their communities, doing really good and important work. In fact, it's those voices that I want to amplify, right? It's those folks who really inspire me. And it's people like that that I write about in the book who are making really big changes with the tool bags that they've got. So I think, yes, privilege matters and should not be discounted in the conversation. And all of us have some work to do. So creative responses to hatred, I think, are the only healthy way forward. There is a lot of anger and hatred in the world, but when we let that anger calcify into hatred, hatred means wishing someone else harm. That's different. You can love someone deeply and be angry with them, right? Anyone who's ever had a family knows that that can be true. But hatred is different. Hatred means wishing someone harm. Even when I'm angry with someone I love, I want the best for them, right? So as we try to figure out how to respond to hatred, I think it's important to not sink into that hatred ourselves, to find ways to heal that. And I think it's really healed through relationship and through compassion. It's amazingly, it sounds so trite to say that love is really what changes the world, but actually it's empirically true. Love is what changes the world. And I mean not just the emotion of love. In fact, I don't even mean the emotion of love. I mean a policy of love, holding up someone else's dignity and value as equivalent to your own and treating them accordingly, no matter how you feel, sometimes in spite of how you feel, rather than because of it.
Thanks, David. Is there anything else you'd like to add that I haven't probably asked you about?
So in November of 2016 in the United States, there was a very contentious election that I think everybody on the planet has probably pretty much heard about when Donald Trump was elected. And I live in a neighborhood in a small town in the South that didn't have a sidewalk on my street for many years. And people would sometimes walk up and down the street, but cars went on that street very, very fast. And I was afraid for them every time I saw somebody walking. And then one day the town actually listened to some complaints from neighbors and came and put the sidewalk in to my neighborhood. And over the next year or two, I watched my neighborhood change as people started walking their babies and walking their dogs and walking down to town along that sidewalk. They started to know each other a little bit, and threads of connection were woven in this neighborhood. And then this election happened in 2016, and I felt like the town had come in and ripped out the sidewalk because my neighbors were all afraid to talk to each other. They didn't know how they voted, and they were literally afraid of what was going to happen next, and they didn't want to deal with the conflict of finding out that they had voted differently from each other. That election mattered a lot. People live and die by elections. I'm not trying to minimize the significance of it. In fact, just the opposite. It matters a great deal. But I found that my neighbors were afraid to talk to me, and I wanted my neighbors to know that no matter who they voted for, I would happily jump their car battery if their car battery was dead. If they needed to borrow some groceries because they were in the middle of making something, they could come and knock on my door. I wanted to let my neighbors know that I still want to be in community. Not because the differences don't matter, but because they do. Our only chance of moving forward is to know each other and love each other because people are very seldom rejected into more compassionate ways of living. So I just wanted to put a sign on my house, and I was saying that to my family one night over dinner. I was so frustrated. I said, "I just want to nail a sign to the front of the house that says, 'Hey, you can knock on our door. You can Talk to us if we can help you in some way, no matter who you voted for, because I think relationship comes first and then transformation happens, not the other way around. We can't demand that people are transformed in order to be in relationship. It is relationship that changes us. So then it occurred to me that I actually know how to have signs made. So, you know, it's always dangerous when you hear yourself say somebody oughta, because then you remember that you're somebody. So I actually did. I had a big sign made and I nailed it to the front of my house. It's 3 feet wide and 8 feet tall. And it says, you are our neighbors, no matter who you vote for, who you love, where you're from, the color of your skin. We will try to be here for you. That's what community means. Let's be neighbors. And I nailed that sign to the front of my house. And it was amazing to see the conversations that grew out of that. As people came and knocked on my door and asked me about the sign, people pulled into the driveway to take pictures of it. And then people started asking where they could get one. And so I started making them for people. And now there's a website, letsbeneighbors.org or .com, that is where people can go and get it. And I feel so strongly about the message that people can actually download the sign and print their own if they want for free. They don't have to pay me anything for it, but they can also order signs if they want to. And now those are hanging across the country on businesses and communities of faith and homes. And I think that matters. I think the stories that grow out of that, the conversations that grow out of that, weave the threads of the fabric of society. And in a time when people are actively trying to cut the fabric of society to shreds, I think it's really important that we not only refrain from cutting the fabric of society, but that we actively weave the threads back together. So I believe in community peacemaking and community justice work. I think all of us can show up for that in our own small ways. And I really think it matters.